From the heartland deep in the Ouachita Mountains of western Arkansas, where the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, the Guerrilla Media Network presents The Reynolds Reveal, the new weekly show that, no matter the limitations that may trammel inquiry elsewhere, sifts and winnows without fear or favor. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and today is Wednesday, December 18, 2013. This is episode number 35 of The Reynolds Reveal. I appreciate you for listening in, and yes, we do welcome your calls here at the Guerrilla Media Network. The number, 218-862-9829. My guests on last week's show were three PhD economists, Lowell Galloway and Richard Vetter from Ohio University, and Mark Thornton from the Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama. And we had a good show reviewing the U.S. political economy of 2013 and their crystal ball gazing for 2014. And today, we're going to leave planet Earth, I believe, for a good part of this show, our pre-Christmas show. And I've got two wonderful people on the line. Gerald White from Sydney, Australia, is the grandson of the Apollo moon hoax theory, following in the footsteps of Bill Kaysing and Ralph Rene. His principal website is moonfaker.com, and he's got White Gerald at YouTube as his own channel. And then we're joined by Andrew Johnson from the UK, who's got plenty of physical science training and insight, and that's something I'm lacking. So I thought we'd have a three-way conversation. Andrew's website is checktheevidence.com, and I'd like to think of him as one of his skills and contributions is as the intellectual historian of 9/11 research. So welcome to the show, Andrew Johnson and Gerald White.
Thanks, Morgan.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Very good. I wanted to start with something that actually made our Arkansas newspaper, and it's in the news. It shows that space travel, manned or unmanned, is noteworthy. And in the headlines here in Sunday's paper, the headline, China reports its spacecraft is on the moon. And I'm going to use a couple minutes here to give you excerpts and then ask for your thoughts, gentlemen. China on Saturday became the third country to land a spacecraft on the moon after its unmanned Chang'e 3, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, probe settled onto the Bay of Rainbows, state television reported. And this is wire service stories that this newspaper account is based on. The probe arrived after a 13-day journey from Earth, but no footage of the landing was shown on Chinese state television. I saw some footage as an aside here when I went to, I guess it was spacenews.com, and that's got some troubling aspects to it. But continuing in the newspaper account, the Chang'e 3 landing craft carried a solar-powered robotic rover called the Jade Rabbit, or Yutu in Mandarin Chinese. And skipping down into the story, they've got a couple of pictures of the control room in Beijing and a rocket lifting off December 2nd. And the story says the United States and former Soviet Union are the only other countries to have accomplished such a lunar mission called the soft landing, which allows a craft to operate after descending. And 37 years have passed since the last such visit. I think I'll stop there and get Jera's comment on what the story says so far. Gerald White.
Well, I've been asked a lot. I've been asked by a lot of people for my thoughts on the Chang'e 3 rover. A lot of people ask me, "Do you think this is real? Do you think this is faked?" And to be perfectly honest, I simply don't have enough data to make a conclusion one way or another. Because the Chinese, they've been very, very what's the word for it, cagey about the data that they've released. So far, all we've ever been given on this Chang'e 3 thing is the videos of the descent, the video of it deploying the rover, and a few photographs taken by the rover and the spacecraft, the landing spacecraft itself, of each other. Now, as I said, I'm not 100% sure about this lander and stuff, but various propagandists have already begun trying to cite it as evidence for Apollo. Now, I'm actually looking at the photographs right now. I've got them saved to my computer. Oh, before we get started, another thing too is that some of these pictures that they've released, rather than it being a direct feed, they've actually been photographed off the screens in Beijing, which that sends some red flags right there, you know. But as I said, I'm not too sure about it. As I said, now as for the photographs themselves, right, there are two pictures of the actual Chang'e 3 lander. These were taken by the rover that it deployed. Now there's one picture, right? It's a wide image of the lander, right? And I'll send you the links if you like. You can see that it's casting a shadow to the right of the screen. It's about a 20-degree angle, I think. And you can see the landscape. The landscape is all correctly exposed. You can make out the little rocks and craters and the like and stuff. Now the shadowed side of the lander is kind of dark. In fact, some sections of it are pitch black. Like the landing legs are pitch black. This panel here is pitch black, and some of it's kind of dark and stuff. Now, as for the other picture that they sent is much brighter, and now the shadowed side is correctly lit up, but the landscape is just a wash of bright light. You can barely make out any topography on the terrain anymore. Now the propagandists, they've been very fond of citing this second picture. They say, oh, this is proof that the landscape can reflect enough sunlight onto the lunar module. That was their excuse for objects being illuminated on the shaded side. You know, like pictures of Aldrin descending the ladder and he's lit up in the shadow, or pictures taken of the sun behind the lunar module and you can read the United States writings on the vehicle itself. It's all lit up and everything. Well, I've done experiments on an asphalt road. The moon's reflectivity or albedo is only 7%. That means of all the sunlight that hits it, it only reflects 7%, right? And so that's the same reflectivity as an asphalt road. Now, I did an experiment.
Gera, what is it on the Earth, the albedo?
7%.
On the moon.
But on the moon?
Yes, on the moon, yes. That's the same reflectivity as an asphalt
road. I'd like to have you give us a comparative. What is it on the Earth, the albedo?
Depends where you are.
Seen from space, the albedo of the Earth is about 40%.
Okay.
Yes. Seen from space, the albedo of Earth is 40%. On the moon's surface, and regardless of whether you're looking at it from the ground here on Earth or when you're on the surface itself, the albedo of the moon is only 7%, which is the same reflectivity as asphalt. All right, so I did an experiment, right? I had a Lego lunar module with an astronaut, right? I put it on the asphalt road. I got this cardboard box. I painted the inside of it black, right, you see, and then I put it over the astronaut. Now, the box itself is to actually shield the model from the blue sky, because on Earth, you see, we have the sunlight being refracted through miles and miles of air molecules, and that blue sky will act as a secondary light source. So the box was to shield it from air. Right, I did the experiment, and I found that if I was to correctly expose the road, correctly expose the landscape, the shadowed side of the astronaut would come out black. If I was to open the aperture up to the point that we can now see the astronaut, the road, which is normally very, very dark, it was just a wash of bright light. You couldn't make out anything. You could see what's in the shadow now, but the road was just overexposed. Right, so as I said, I don't know if the Chang'e 3 is for real, but if this is for real, then these photographs that they've released backs up my experiment, because the only way they could expose the shadowed side of the Chang'e lander was by opening up the aperture to the point that the landscape is now very overexposed. You can just barely make out any of the details on the surface.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's scientifically okay or consistent, that photo.
Yeah, some, yeah, others have, yeah, that's from a lighting perspective, I should say. The, some have argued that there isn't any blast crater underneath the rover, I mean, underneath the Chang'e lander, but there's, I took the liberty of looking up the specs for this vehicle. This engine is much less than the Apollo Lunar Module. At full thrust, its descent engine is only 1/6 of the Apollo Lunar Lander's thrust, and its lowest thrust is 1/30 of that. And yeah. I did the count. That works out to be something like 300 pounds of thrust. I've seen videos of a rocket being tested with only 500 pounds of thrust. It burned a crater in the ground, but only after firing at the concrete for about 25 seconds.
Right.
I presume that if the rocket was much powerful, it would dig a hole much sooner.
And yeah, the Apollo lander was what, 5,000 or 10,000 pounds of thrust, and it would have melted rock. And
yeah, it was 10,000 pounds of thrust, but NASA claimed that they reduced the pressure to only 2,500 pounds of thrust. But still, that's a lot more than the 500 pound thrust engine that Armadillo Aerospace did with their test module. They had only had a 500 pound engine, and it burned a hole in concrete after firing at it for about 25 seconds. And now the Chinese, they also claim that they shut the engine down when it was only 4 meters above the surface. In fact, Gene Cernan, he actually claimed something similar when asked why there was no burn crater underneath his lamp. Of course, I showed that wasn't the case, at least on Apollo 11, because you could still, the engine was still running after they touched down for about a few seconds afterwards. You can hear them say contact lights, and then a few seconds later they say engine stop. You know, the contact light is that probes underneath the foot pad, so when it touches the surface, it lights up a little light in the capsule, in the cockpit, sorry. And so, yeah.
Okay, now, Jarrah, hold on. I know you got about four more subjects on this to discuss, but let me intervene and ask for Andrew Johnson's comment to this point.
Sure. Yeah, sure. Very interesting stuff, Jarrah. Thank you. I watched the landing video the alleged landing video, we perhaps might call it, and it was quite interesting to compare that to the Apollo landing. And I noted some of the points about the thrust as it was approaching the ground. But there's a particular point in the descent where the vehicle seems to stop, and it's like it's looking for a landing site or looking for a specific point on the ground, and then it gradually goes down. And that again seems to me somewhat more realistic, in that they would indeed make some course corrections, you know, to ensure they didn't land on a rock, which they hadn't obviously been able to see before they got there. Because of course, if this thing lands on a rock and tips on its side, then that could make the successful operation, you know, either 100 times more difficult and so on. So that again to me seemed more realistic when I was watching it. So you know, I'm still sort of going to obviously review this with interest as well.
It looked to me like there was this effort to adjust. I might call it hovering. But there were, one thing bothered me. I watched this 3 minute and 28 minute clip, 3:28, and one thing that bothered me initially, and I'll ask Jarrah White about this, is it seemed as if there was zero noise, vibration, and harshness, as the automotive engineers call it. And maybe this rocket engine is gentle enough, but there wasn't any vibration going on disturbing the video aboard. Does that make sense, Jarrah White? Did you see that?
I watched the video. Initially, when they were broadcasting this thing, they didn't actually show the video. Initially, they just showed little still pictures from the video that would update a few seconds later. Sometime after the landing, they actually showed the raw video. As for whether or not it would make any engine noise, I'm honestly not sure if it even had any audio recording equipment on the lander. Yeah. I don't think it would carry any audio record devices.
Yeah, it was silent. It was silent. More the vibration, the lack of vibration, it seems amazing to me.
Yeah, I didn't notice that. I'll have to have another look at the video. One thing that I did find quite interesting, though, about that video is that just before, a few seconds before it actually lands, you can actually see the dust beginning to be disturbed. In fact, you actually see what I can only describe as a little like vortex of the dust getting disturbed, and this was just a few seconds before the landing. Interestingly enough, some of the pro-NASA side have actually cited this as evidence for Apollo. They say, "Oh, well, look, it's kicking up the dust, and you can't see a plume. Oh, that's proof that the Apollo lunar module shouldn't have made a visible engine plume, because like when the in the footage when you see the ascent stage going up from the moon, you don't see any flames coming out the bottom of the engine." Well, I think they'd best take a look at the launch of this spacecraft actually being deployed. Now, the fuels that the spacecraft used, China, they haven't actually said what the fuels are, but it's believed that it used the same fuels as the Apollo lunar module. It used nitrogen tetroxide and unsymmetrical dimethyl hydrazine, or UDMH. Now, the Apollo spacecraft also used hydrazine mixed with the UDMH. That's called aerozine 50, but it would still produce a visible plume. I've actually seen pictures of it being tested in a vacuum chamber. But anyways, the videos of the Chang'e rover being actually launched, you know, in Earth orbit, you know, when they launch it into space and it separates from its upper launch vehicle when it's going out into space, you can actually see the thrusters firing its jets. It starts like this enormous plume, this enormous white plume that just expands off into space. And then we see the descent engine. It used the descent engine to actually make the trans-Earth injection burn, and you can actually see it just glows. I watched the news feed, and it actually just glows brightly like you wouldn't believe, like almost like it exploded almost. And the Russian, sorry, I'm not Russian. I was saying Russian. The Chinese news commentators they all remarked on how bright it was. You'd actually see it there. Now, so we see this enormous bright plume during the departure from Earth. During the landing, we don't really see any plume. So I have two theories for that. One is that it was faked, or maybe we can't see the plume in this case is because when it finally reached the surface, you see as the plume expands out, eventually it cools into the infrared and you can no longer see it. Right. So maybe it was just the infrared portion of it that was disturbing the soil. Had we had a rover or spacecraft already set up on the surface of the moon to actually record it descending, maybe we probably would have seen just how clear the plume was during the descent and when it finally faded to the infrared. So as I said, I'm not too sure about this rover, but that's just, I need more data to make a conclusion out of it.
You know, this whole thing, and let me ask you, Andrew, and then get Jerris, this whole thing about a soft landing is a very delicate thing to back on down and get a real landing. Because I can recall Neil Armstrong almost getting killed when he tried one on planet Earth with that simulator. Even though you've got these fringe or peripheral, you can lose it pretty easily. So it would be quite a technological feat for the Chinese government to manage this soft landing.
Yeah, well, I could probably make a few comments in response to that, I think. And again, I think what Jarrah said there in his explanation was very interesting about the fuel. And obviously that's very well researched. And I think it's great to have that sort of knowledge presented. But just as a few additional points, perhaps, yes, Neil Armstrong I think the simulator crashed on its first or second test, and he was nearly killed, as you said. So, you know, there's the old thing of that thing failed on Earth, but worked successfully six times in a row in space. You know, how likely is that? Again, going back to the Chinese technology, where, you know, 40 years on now, and perhaps one thing that they may have employed in the design of the vehicle is, you know, more advanced gyroscopic controls. I mean, you know, one thing that came to mind while you were speaking there, Morgan, was these toys that you can now get, you know, the helicopters, these remote controlled helicopters, which can stay level in the air. There's a very impressive video you can watch about servo control robocopters, and there's this guy, and they've got onboard electronics and basically a fairly fast computer on board, and they're only about the size of a basketball, a bit bigger than a basketball, and this guy was like grabbing hold of this thing and pulling it down in the air whilst it's in the air, and then he'd let go and the thing would rise up to a specific height again and then stop because it had a GPS locator on it as well. Now, the GPS probably wouldn't work on the moon, of course, but the gyroscopic controls are much better now, and that sort of technology is much better, which may have assisted in the stabilization and the landing of the craft and made that much more, more of an easy technological feat than it would have been with Apollo.
And then funny you should mention those helicopters. I think I received one of those as a Christmas present a few years ago.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, that satisfies me that this soft landing is much more plausible today than it was in 1969. Smooth flight adjustments to make in mid-course corrections. Mm. Very good.
Oh, one thing I forgot to mention earlier when I was talking about how they've correctly exposed the landscape, the shadowed side of the lander is dark. When they've opened the aperture up, it's the surface is all bright and stuff. Now, the Soviets, they actually also landed their own soft landers on the moon. They landed two rovers in the 1970s, Lunokhod 1 and Lunokhod 2. I recently found a photograph taken by Lunokhod 1. It took a picture of the Luna 17 spacecraft that landed it. Now, the picture itself is pretty awful by today's standards. You know, it's all grainy and everything else, but the shadowed side of the Luna 17 is dark. It's dark. The landscape is still correctly exposed. You can't see the shadowed side of it. Mm. So that's interesting to correlate with my experiment with the Chinese rover and the Apollo project.
Yeah.
Hey, let me go back, Jared, and get your comment about the fuel, because in our newspaper there was a story just below that about the Chinese landing on the moon. Headline: Iran sends monkey to space. Second primate trip is step to launch man, officials say. And this is from the AP, Tehran, and it says it's Iran's. They went up 72 miles and supposedly recovered the live monkey. And it was Iran's first use of liquid fuel. So my question is this Chinese rocketry solid or liquid fuel?
I believe that they're using liquid rockets. I'd have to look it up. I recall it being a liquid rocket. They're using the Long March. I forget if it's Long March 3, but it's the Long March rockets. They used liquid fuel. Solid fuels are only really used during the first stage firings. You know, they're used for additional lifting capacity, and once they've burned out, they need to be jettisoned to save weight, because otherwise you're just carrying pretty much dead steel.
I see. Yeah, in this story, in this new AP account, it says, quote, "The rocket carrying the first monkey used solid fuel and had a high speed. But a liquid fuel rocket has a lower speed and is better for the safety and protection of the living creature because it causes less pressure." This is an Iranian spokesperson. And he continues, "The capsule was equipped with a shock absorber to provide better protection." And quote, they want to know, we're not into animal cruelty.
I haven't paid that much attention to the Iranian space program, to be perfectly honest with you. You should mention that actually, because I actually saw it on the news. I was watching the news about the Chang'e 3 lander. Everyone who knows me personally knows that whenever there's something going on in space, I always set the video up to record any news reports there are about it. And I remember distinctly after they talked about Chang'e 3, they made a mention about the Iranian monkey launch. And the reporter, they never said they did it. They just said Iran claims to have sent it. And towards the very end of this was on the SBS News. Towards the very end of the program, they mentioned how the previous one, there was some doubts about that because the pictures of the monkey, apparently, I think this is their second monkey launch. The first monkey launch, they showed the pictures of the monkey prior to takeoff, and the monkey that they retrieved, the photos showed a different monkey.
Very good. Walking on the moon. We're listening to the Reynolds Reveal, and I've got two guests who are out of this world, Andrew Johnson. So let's learn more about space travel and exploration. Giant steps are what you do. welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and we do welcome callers. The number, 218-862-9829. I've got two wonderful and knowledgeable guests, Andrew Johnson from UK and Jarrah White from down under, Sydney, Australia, to be more precise. And we are talking about exploration of space. I had to do an out-of-this-world show here as holidays come up. And just before the break, I think Jarrah White was talking about this whole problem of validation or proof. Can we believe these governments? And I want to bring up two comments that are in my newspaper account. And the AP story about Iran launching monkeys 72 miles into space says, where is that? Iran, quote, Iran frequently claims technological breakthroughs that can't be independently verified. Well, that you wouldn't find that in a story looking at U.S. Space exploration, I don't believe. By contrast, in the Chinese account about the Chang'e 3, I quote from the Wire reports, quote, some Chinese space engineers have endorsed eventually taking astronauts to the moon and back, which would make China the second country after the U.S. to achieve that feat. Well, where is your proof, you know, that? So, Jarrah, I'd like your response to that, and then get Andrew.
Yeah, the Chinese, they have been talking about plans to land men on the moon for a while now, but I haven't seen that. They haven't disclosed what vehicles they're planning to get. But the whole fact of the matter is that they need to shield themselves from the radiation, otherwise they're not going to be going anywhere. And currently, they've got a three-step program, or four-step if you count the manned phase of everything. They wanted to send probes around the moon. They've done that with Chang'e 1 and Chang'e 2. Then they say they wanted to make a soft landing on the moon, which they've claimed to have done with Chang'e 3. Did it land? Did it not land? I have no idea. You know, I don't have enough data yet to verify that. And the next phase is to send a soil sample return mission, which that's supposed to be done on Chang'e 5. They plan on landing an unmanned probe on the moon, drilling up some soil, and take it back to the Earth. So that would be pretty interesting because, if you recall back to the last time I was on this show, I mentioned how the Soviet samples that the Russians brought back, they were chemically different to the samples that the Americans claim they brought back on Apollo. I think one of the most significant things is that the American samples, they contained ferric iron, which the Soviet samples do not. Ferric iron, you can only get that by exposing the iron that's in the rocks to a water and oxygen-rich atmosphere for a long time. You know, you expose it to these conditions, it rusts the iron. And then there's also the water that's comparable to that of Earth rocks. Like the range for water in Earth rocks is, I believe, 150 parts per million to 10,000 parts per million. The highest quantity of water that the Americans brought back was 6,000 parts per million. Now, none of the first two Soviet samples, they didn't contain any water. The third one, Luna 24, contained 1,000 parts per million, but only after they drilled about 2 meters under the surface to find it. So it should be interesting to see.
When you're talking about iron rust, that's ferric oxide, right? Sarah.
Yes,
Eric. Okay, Andrew Johnson.
Yes.
You're an expert on the corporate media because I just gave you a couple of quotes. Isn't it asymmetric? Aren't they being a little insipid or? They're critical about Iran, but not when it comes to the U.S. Claims about manned missions in outer space.
Oh, right. I mean, they don't bring up the idea that this is all propaganda. And, you know, the information is tightly controlled. So we don't really have, as ordinary citizens, a good way of verifying this information. it all comes through official agencies that have got vested interests of one kind or another, you know, and I think once you start to shift your thinking a little bit, then it becomes a lot more difficult to sort out all the issues that, you know, come to light. And so, yeah, the whole idea of verification then, well, who verifies who? And I was very, very interested to hear what Jarrah was saying about the rock samples being very different, because I wasn't aware of that. But that ties up with, of course, the unusual reporting in the BBC about 3 or 4 years ago now, where they had the Dutch moon rock, which was revealed as a fake, and it was revealed as a bit of petrified wood, according to this.
Yeah, Jarrah has quite an interesting experience along that line, right? When he confronted...
I met Buzz Aldrin at a press conference. I asked him about the rock, and he was very, very nervous about it. He was like, petrified wood. Well, that doesn't sound like that came from the moon. And then he tried to suggest that it had been switched at some stage.
Yeah.
You know, is that then the very next day, full page headline on the back of the Sydney Morning Herald the next day, the headline, security, we have a problem.
Wow.
Let's go back to the Chinese. I think I haven't exhausted that. I've got such knowledgeable guests here. So let me stimulate conversation by a couple more quotes from this story. But the mission also embodies China's broader ambitions in space. The Chang'e 3 mission is to hone technology for future missions while also exploring, and Jarrah White touched on that. And here's somebody named Peter Bond, consultant editor for Jane Space Systems and Industry. He says, it's still a significant technological challenge to land on another world, especially somewhere like the moon, which doesn't have an atmosphere, so you can't use parachutes or anything like that. You have to use rocket motors for the descent, and you have to make sure you go down at the right angle and the right rate of descent and don't end up in a crater or on top of a rock. And Andrew addressed that, I thought, pretty convincingly about the gyroscopic advantages or gains that have been made since 1969. And then here's another part of this story. Some Chinese space engineers have endorsed eventually taking astronauts to the moon and back, which would make China the second. Oh, I did that one already. Okay. Okay, that's enough stimulus. Let's hear your comment there, Jarrah White. Anything come to mind?
One thing that comes to mind is the manned space program. Honestly, I really am skeptical of the Chinese, especially their when it comes to their manned space program. I haven't seen their various space station videos or anything. I stopped paying much attention to their manned space program after the spacewalk, because their spacewalk turned out to be a fake. They were filled I forget the astronaut's name. Well, they're called taikonauts, I guess, but I forget the guy's name right now. But the videos of him walking outside the spacecraft, they turned out to be filmed in a swimming pool. Mm. You know, when they train astronauts to walk out in space, they actually put them in this gigantic underwater swimming pool thing. They put them in this gigantic water tank, because that way they get to experience natural buoyancy for extended periods. You know, before that they were using the Vomit Comet to simulate their spacewalks, but it only lasted 30 seconds. And underwater, you get much prolonged time to practice. Now, it was believed that the videos of them walking in space was actually filmed in a swimming pool, because you could see little bubbles floating out of the spacecraft. And I actually spoke to this jet propulsion laboratory engineer by the name of Dr. Q Zeng. He had stated in the newspapers that he believed that the Chinese spacewalk video was faked. I sent him an email asking him, and he said, yes, that's what I believe. And he added that he did some calculations, right? The pictures of the Earth seen at the time, they did not match up with the way the Earth should have appeared at the time. Like, he did some simulations of okay, this is what the Earth will look like from this position of the orbit. Okay, this is what it should look like. This is what it looks like in the videos. That they don't match up. That was what he told me. This is Dr. Q Zeng, who works at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory engineer.
Who
works at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
Oh, yeah, California.
Yes, that's correct. Yes, I asked him. I asked him what he thought of the Apollo program, but he didn't answer along those lines. It's a rarity when someone actually someone on the inside blows the whistle on a space plane.
Andrew Johnson, a comment?
Yeah, well, one thing that came to my mind as you were talking about that was this, you know, Hollywood's role in terms of the, you know, I was recommended this Gravity film featuring Sandra Bullock and George Clooney, which came out, I think, about a month, 6 weeks ago or something, maybe a bit longer. And that, why I mentioned that is that that actually features the Chinese space station as part of the plot. And, you know, I have to wonder if that was kind of part of a propaganda exercise, you know, and this, I mean, if you watch the whole film, it, you know, it's quite an entertaining film for what it is, and they've obviously been very meticulous in their reproduction of the space vehicles, or that's what it appears from my limited knowledge of them anyway. Have you seen that film, Gerard, at all, the Gravity film?
Yes, I saw that, and let me tell you, I was actually blown away by its visual effects. I wouldn't call the film 100% scientifically accurate because they take a number of liberties with the like the positions of the spacecrafts. Like you couldn't really spacewalk from like the Hubble to the International Space Station as depicted in the film because like they're at one's at 300 kilometers above the Earth, the other's at 500 kilometers, and they've both got different trajectories, so that's impossible. But most of the time, the visual effects there's some obvious CGI here and there, but a lot of the time it looks photorealistic. You actually get the feeling like you're actually there. And for a while, I was stumped as to how they filmed the zero gravity scenes, particularly on the inside of the spacecraft, because they just seem to last forever. They just seem to go on for prolonged periods. You know, you could. At first, I thought they were using the Vomit Comet, but as I said, the Vomit Comet thing only lasts for about 30 seconds. And I read about how they filmed it. Apparently, Sandra Bullock was very good at holding her breath for a long period, so they actually filmed her in front of a green screen underwater, swimming around the place. And that's how they filmed those scenes. I had absolutely no idea.
Right. Yeah. Well, I hadn't really looked into the special effects, but yeah, I just from a propaganda point of view, I thought it was interesting that the Chinese space station was put into that. You know, I mean, they could have set it like 10 years ago or 15 years ago or something like that, when that didn't exist, or they could have just changed the scenario slightly so that the Chinese space station wasn't in there or something, but they didn't. Obviously, they chose to include that. So, you know.
As I said, I hadn't really paid much attention to their space station stuff. I watched the first three lander launches that the Chinese have claimed to have done. If I recall correctly, the first one, they didn't broadcast that live. The second one, they supposedly did broadcast that one live, but they were only allowing Chinese reporters to the launch site, and they actually made the Chinese reporters actually hand over any films that they took to the government so they could, you know, view it before they could actually see it. And then there was the third one with the spacewalk filmed in a swimming pool. I think they had sent two more after that. I honestly don't remember. I hadn't paid much attention to their space station claims. But so I'm skeptical about their first three.
Well, according to this newspaper account, Jera, it says, quote, "The nation sent its first astronaut into orbit in 2003 and has since carried out four more manned missions. It conducted its first spacewalk in 2008.
Okay.
So they've allegedly gone five times into orbit, low Earth orbit.
Yeah.
Now, you know, one thing that I think is kind of good about this whole Chinese thing, and then here there's talk in India about putting a rocket into orbit around Mars, is it brings up this whole renews this whole business of optimism about exploring our solar system. And this guy, Peter Bond, consultant editor for Jane Space Systems and Industry, says the Chinese, are taking their time with getting to know about how to fly humans into space, how to build space stations, how to explore the solar system, especially the moon and Mars, unquote. But it still bothers me, Jera. You and I are in complete agreement on the whole radiation problem hasn't been solved, nothing even close to it. So this business about flying humans out into the Van Allen Belt and beyond is just nonsense to me. Is it to you?
Yeah, it's nonsense because a lot of people are talking about these ambitious plans to go into deeper space, like go back to the moon, I say that very loosely because that's what everyone claims, you know, but they haven't gone there in the first time. They all talk about going to the moon and going to Mars, but they just don't have that technology to they talk about shielding their ships, but all the shields that they always talk about, they're always so understated. Like the first tourist in space, Dennis Tito, he's proposing sending a married couple around Mars, not orbiting Mars, but simply on a flyby around Mars and back to the Earth. But he proposed, get this right, he proposes initially shielding the ship with bags of water. The bags, if I recall correctly, the bags of water would be about 25 centimeters thick. All right, that's not thick enough. He proposes using the same water for drinking and storing the waste products in this shield. Once, you know, okay, we drink the water. Okay, I need to take a dump. Okay, take a dump in the bag. I'm not kidding you. He plans on using feces as the radiation shield.
But, well, can we say that sounds like a crap idea?
Hey, oh my God. I disagree. I have an RV. You have a freshwater tank, you have gray water tank, and then you have black water. The commode.
Yeah. Well, the point is, in all seriousness, though, feces apparently has a similar density to water, so it would have the same shielding effect. But the fact of the matter is that his shield is way too thin.
Oh.
25 centimeters of water, that's only 25 grams per square centimeter. To offer adequate protection, it needs to be at least 200 grams per square centimeter.
Right.
And so in terms of, if you're using water, that would be 2 meters of water. And Elon Musk, he recently announced that his rocket that he intends on taking to people to Mars will be called the Mars Colonial Transporter. And initially he said, oh, all you need is just one column of water and hit that pointer to the sun. I wrote to him, I sent him emails on his Twitter account, and I produced a video pointing out that his column of water would not work because he needs to shield all sides of the spacecraft because you might think that solar flares are directional, but they're not, because the radiation that is shot out into space by these flares, they're all deflected in all directions by the sun's magnetic field, and that's why you need to have all sides of the spaceship protected. And when he went on to announce about a month after he made this proclamation that he just needed a column of water, he said that the radiation problem needed to be solved. So in summary, he says, okay, we just need a column of water. I tell him, no, that's not going to work because of this and that. And then a few months later, he says, okay, we need to solve the radiation problem. So hopefully he's realized his mistake. I can only hope so. Because if they do not take immediate steps to solve the radiation problem, then I fear that we risk the chance of losing an astronaut in space by the most horrific way imaginable. Death by
fried,
space radiation.
Yeah. Fried
astronaut.
Andrew.
Yeah, I think relating to that subject, this Adrian chap that I think both Jarrett and I are in contact with, who runs a site called AWE130, where he's collected, he's been looking a lot at the ALSJ, which is the Apollo something journal.
Apollo Lunar
Surface Journal, right, thanks. And, you know, he actually sent me a message just before we came on, Gerard, and it was about the flag, and the flag that was put outside the space station on the Russian, I think, on the Russians, either the International Space Station, no, the Mir Space Station, probably it was.
Mir Space Station.
So you might like to tell, the listeners about that, because I found that very interesting, and I don't know if Morgan knows about that.
Yeah, this actually could be could segue into something that I've been wanting to talk about as well on the program. The Russians, they actually deployed a Soviet flag on the outside of the I talked about this last time I was on the show.
Yeah.
They deployed a Soviet flag outside the spacecraft, outside the Mir space station, and over time it began to be destroyed by micrometeoroids and the radiation. You know, the radiation itself in Earth orbit is not felt as strongly as it is in Earth orbit, as it is on the moon, but it's still enough to damage the flag over time. And eventually, right, when they, about a year It was definitely, I forget how many days it was exactly. It was 400 something days. And when they went about to retrieve the flag, there was only two threads of it left. Now, I recently posted a video about that. It's called Moonfaker LRO Flag or No Flag. Right? I quoted the Russian sources in it. And one fellow, we used to be friends a while back, but he showed his true colors as a troll a long time ago. He went into the comments accusing me of being, quote, deliberately deceptive because I didn't supposedly because I only commented on the micrometeoroids. No, I also commented on the radiation hazard as well. I specifically said that in on the moon, it will be felt much stronger. And he started going on about, oh, what about the ozone residues? Because, like, the quote mentioned the ozone residues having an effect on the flag. Well, in space, right, where we're sitting on the Earth right now, it's something like 10 to the 19 molecules per cubic centimeter. Right? In space, it's something like 10 per cubic centimeter, right? And so in Earth orbit, in the atmosphere, right, the ozone is very, very minuscule. The most where you'll get is in the ozone layer. And even in the ozone layer, it's only about 10 parts per million. That's only 10. So that's like, I forget
anything. It's small.
It's very, very small. And obviously, if it's just residue space, it's going to be even less. Right, I pointed out, I gave him the numbers. I don't remember the numbers offhand right now, but he ignored my numbers, and he just went carrying on calling me deliberately deceptive, so I blocked him. And after that, he developed some kind of irrational personal vendetta against me. He began posting in just a week, he posted five videos in a row, all calling me deliberately deceptive. Right, and finally, I complained to YouTube, and they pulled his videos for harassment. Right, and He then vowed revenge. He released a video in which he threatened to file, quote, all kinds of felonious DMCAs and terms of service violations on Jarrah White's videos. Every one of his videos, quote, because I don't care. I will do that. End quote.
Wow.
So he's this guy is a punk child. He's only like 14 years old, I think. We used to be friends. He used to be a follower of my work, and he actually supported me a lot of the times, but, you know, and he later turned out to be a troll. He trolled Ralph Rene incognito, and after...
what, at age 7? 6 and 7? Didn't you say he's only 14 years old?
Yeah, he's 14 years old. Apparently he trolled Ralph Rene after he died.
Oh, okay.
Probably earlier this year. Anyways, I don't waste my time on punker children. In fact, a while ago, I made it clear that I stopped worrying about what propagandists and trolls say about me personally, because I consider them to be the human centipede. All they do is they feed shit to their followers, who in turn feed the same recycled shit to others. And so if we're talking about centipedes, right, if we're talking about sections, right, this kid would have to be the rear piece.
But, you know, Jarrah White is makes it sound like you're a very lonely, productive truth seeker, vastly outnumbered, you know, like 100 to 1 or something. And I noticed in space.com, which seems to be an establishment defender of the orthodoxy, they were quoting some poll recently where 7% of Americans doubt that the Apollo missions were true, that we've ever landed a man on the moon. And my thought is, isn't it amazing this 40-plus years later how they've kept this thing boxed up? You know, like Jarrah White is some kind of a nut or something we can dismiss, and yet you bring enormous evidence to the proving the falsehood of this whole it's a big lie. And it's amazing that this critical attitude about Apollo and manned moon flights hasn't made more headway in the body politic, isn't it?
Yeah.
What do you say, Andrew?
Yeah, well, I suppose my response to that, a couple of things I would say briefly, is it's something that, you know, what Gerard described there with the centipede, we've experienced, and I like that actual description that he's given, that this information is passed from one segment to the next and eventually just, you know, comes out the other end, and it's just what comes out at the end of the rear end of something, you know, that's exactly what it is. And we've experienced that, you know, both you, Morgan, with the work on the 9/11 planes or lack of planes research, and Dr. Judy Wood with the research into the destruction of the World Trade Center, and to a lesser extent myself, you know, I've experienced it a bit, but not as much as Gerard or as Dr. Wood and yourself have. So it's this, I think, is part of the control mechanism. That we probably have a number of centipedes that are, I don't know, they're bred in some lab somewhere and then released into the information community to sort of process this information and make sure that there are all these piles of poop left everywhere that people end up stepping in, and they don't really then want to get involved in seeing what the initial products were, the initial food, if you will, of the information. They don't ever seem to be able to find that, because it's all being consumed and covered up. So I think that's part of the management process of all of keeping these secrets well and firm, you know, well and truly secrets. And it
shows how mythology, how important mythology and history are. History is so important. You have the same thing. We just had the 50th anniversary of the JFK assassination. And that's still incredible to see how this lone assassin, the lone nut myth is clung to, especially in it's obvious in the corporate media, you know, USA Today, the New York Times, etc. And here we have the same thing about Apollo. And some people will say, oh, it's not important, you know, whether we went or not. Oh, no. There's a lot of effort. Look at all the – and Jarrah White, let's go to – this ties right into your YouTube channel, or your videos are under attack. So explain what's going on there.
Okay, well, basically what's happened is right, when you post a video, right, is if you post somebody else's content, right, and if you've used their content inappropriately, right, then you can just then you can ask YouTube to have it removed, right? You file what's called a Digital Millennium copyright infringement takedown, right? And YouTube they receive anything, you explain why your copyrighted material has been abused, and then they have it pulled. Well, unfortunately, right, they've really become extremely criminally negligent, because like. They, a while ago, my videos were stolen and just vandalized and whatever for harassment and humiliation purposes and stuff like that. A lot of those videos have since been removed for terms of service violations. But after this kid got his account pulled because of those harassment reports I filed on him, you know, he was harassing me for about a whole week, released 5 videos in a row, following me deliberately, deceptively, ignored, he created multiple accounts and whatever, his account was terminated for it. And so out of revenge, he's begun filing copyright infringement takedowns on my videos. He's threatened to do that on all. Well, when you file the takedown, right, you file it under penalty of perjury. Right, and I've got video of him essentially saying that he plans on filing these takedowns illegitimately. So far, he's pulled down 2 videos that in which I responded to him. He, as I said, we were once friends. He was once a moon hoax, so he changed sides a few years ago. And I made 2 response videos to 2 of the things that he said. One was about fall off, which is an uneven spread of light across the lunar surface, which is seen in a few photographs. He was responding to that. I responded back to him. And recently he claimed to have contacted a couple of meteorologists about if you could predict cloud patterns. He has a very poor grasp on the definitions, right? The argument is that you could see the cloud patterns seen in the Apollo videos. You could compare them to the weather satellites taken at the time. And he says, okay, these are just see you after the break.
We have a signal that we are hearing a break. Welcome back to Planet Earth. We are doing the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds. We are discussing space exploration, who's legit, who's not. And my 2 guests know quite a bit about this. Jarrah White from Australia and Andrew Johnson from the UK. Andrew's website is checktheevidence.com, and Jera White's principal website is moonfaker.com. I'm wondering, Jera, if we pick up on your the problems with I could call it harassment about your videos and infringement attacks on YouTube. Is this what's your feeling? Is this a tempest in a teapot? Is this just the crankiness of this kind of controversial area? Or do you feel like sometimes it's trolls who are on NASA payrolls or, you know, professional propagandists? Maybe it's just hired students tapping out junk. But what's your impression?
Well, I guess it all depends really on who the attacker is. Some of them are just trolls. Like, as I said, the one who's currently filing these fraudulent takedowns on my videos is only like 14 years old. But in the past, I have had my account suspended, my other account suspended by Mark Gray, who was the head of Spacecraft Films, which is this company that releases, quote, uncut raw footage from NASA, from the Apollo missions, from everything else. And, well, I watched his Apollo 10 DVD, and I compared it with the transcript, and I found that the footage had been censored in parts, and the footage that was broadcast was not live at all, because you could see the camera cutting all over the place every now and then, and yet the audio would remain uncut. Right, I posted this in a video called Flagging the Gems, and what's Mark Gray do? He has the video pulled. He has the video pulled, files copyright infringement takedowns on the video, even though the videos that I posted, the NASA footage is public domain. You know, you could use it, I could use it. You know, he has no copyright claim to this, and yet here he is flagging my videos with copyright infringement takedowns. He gets my old YouTube account suspended. Right, I've since posted the videos again on my new account, which is the White Jera account, and now I'm under attack by this punker child. I posted two videos in response to him. One was the video about fall off, which is the uneven spread of light across the lunar surface. The other one was about predicting cloud patterns. He had contacted a couple of meteorologists about if he could predict cloud patterns as they would appear 3 days into the future. Right, I told him that what you can do to predict cloud patterns is that you have a geostationary satellite in orbit taking pictures of the Earth over periods of times, right? And scientists can actually use these photographs to calculate the cloud speeds and everything else. And they say, okay, this is how these clouds will appear in the future. Okay, we make models predicting what these clouds are going to look like. And so that could be done in the 60s. I got, you know, papers from 1971, for example, you know, basically saying exactly what I said. And this kid, he ignores these papers or didn't bother to look them up, and he contacted two meteorologists, right? But he asked them the wrong questions. He kept using the wrong terminology. He said, can you predict weather patterns? Weather patterns refers to weather conditions that repeat several days in a row. Like if it was raining all week or if it was sunny all week, this has nothing to do with cloud patterns. These are two different things. And so you ask the people. I contacted one of the meteorologists who he contacted. He goes by the name of Elliot Jacks. He works at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. I gave him the correct information, basically what I'm proposing. Right? I asked him, can you confirm the ability to predict cloud patterns based on days or weeks' worth of satellite photographs? And he said this was outside his area of expertise, which is a complete... He gives this kid a detailed answer, right, based on this erroneous, jumbled up question. Right? I give him the right information, and he says, I'm sorry, you'd have to contact a satellite expert about this. And I posted that in my video. I posted the reports and everything. And obviously, it's fair use to use other people's material if you're going to be reviewing or critiquing it, right? I take a clip from his video, play that clip, and then I comment on what he said in it, right? He filed DMCA takedowns on it, which is he's tried to say, oh well, you've done this in the past to other people. Well, the only people who I have asked YouTube to remove the video didn't use my material to review it. They used it to attack me. Like I didn't, unlike various opponents, I did not take your face and paste it onto a picture of a vagina. You know, that's how sick some of these people really are. Oh, yeah. They've done that to my face in the past, and obviously, you know, if someone vandalized your picture in such a way using your copyrighted material, you'd be perfectly justified in asking YouTube to remove it.
Yeah.
Anyways, certainly. And now that he's followed the takedowns of my videos, right, my account is in no longer in good standing, and so my account risks getting terminated. But I've filed the counter notifications already. I don't expect, when you file a counter notification, right, then the other person has to respond to YouTube with a court order, basically explaining why this material cannot be reinstated. And I don't expect to hear from his lawyer anytime soon, because I doubt he has a lawyer. And so I imagine the damage done to my account will be removed by New Year's Eve. But as a precaution, I have directed my subscribers to my other account, which is called The Jarrah White, which I used when I was still under attack by Mark Gray. I used this to post my documentary on the Apollo 1 fire. So if you subscribe to my account, I encourage you to subscribe to my other account, The Jarrah White, and. Yeah, so the damage will hopefully be undone by New Year's Eve. So just for now, just subscribe to this other account that I put out.
This business about changing sides is interesting. We've got a case in 9/11, Jeff Hill, pumpitout.com, who was very effective, no planer. He would call up Boeing spokesperson or NIST and get incriminating responses from them, and then he changed sides. But old Jeff Hill seemed to be short of income, and possibly, I don't know this for a fact, but somebody like that might be biddable in changing sides. So you don't know what people's motives are. So it's just interesting. Andrew.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting to hear what lengths people have gone to block and obfuscate the efforts of Jarrah. And as Dr. Judy Wood and I think yourself have said, when the flak is strongest when you're over the target. And I think that's almost certainly the case here. And just in response to an earlier question, what I found was, for example, I've spoken on a number of programs like this, and when asked and invited, which I'm very pleased to do, and our other mutual friend Morgan Richard D. Hall, I did a discussion of the Apollo stuff with Richard, and I did quite a few discussions of 9/11 with Richard, but after the Apollo one, I got more emails, not nasty emails, I'd say, but ones that were quite upset that I should be questioning the Apollo mission's authenticity. I got more email about the Apollo missions than I did about 9/11. So that was indicative to me what the strength of feeling was about this particular area of study when you look into it.
I had the same experience, Andrew, where I have on my website, nomoregames.net, this article that I originally ran on lewrockwell.com, the libertarian-oriented website, and I never got – I was pointing out the problems with Apollo when I saw this article about this Rube Goldberg system they had to land the Curiosity rover on Mars. Mm-hmm. And they talked about, for example, about the dust-up and all that difficulty. They wanted to avoid that, so – and I must have had at least two dozen emails, which is an unusual response, because I've published a number of articles on lewrockwell.com, and maybe one third of them were favorable. They liked the way I handled this. They said this is a real knee slapper. But a dozen plus people were really emotionally upset.
Yeah.
That I could question the man's greatest technological achievement. And yet when you look at, like the LM is just a piece of junk. I saw it down there in, near Houston, in Texas, where, the NASA Apollo program, mission headquarters and all that. It's just a piece of junk. And to believe that you actually, but people are gullible, I think.
Yeah.
They're credulous. Yeah, credulous. Jarrah, any response there?
Yeah, I saw one of the little modules on display at the Smithsonian when I went there a few years ago, and I have the same thoughts. This thing looks very, very very flimsy. And, you know, at first I thought, well, this was, is this just a model of the thing? But I looked it up and no, this is an unflown Luton module. The one that's on display at the Smithsonian was supposed to be used on the second unmanned flight. They had Apollo 5, which launched a uncrewed LEM into Earth orbit, you know, to fire its engine, see how that would handle and stuff. And they were supposed to have repeated this test, but they didn't fly it, and it's now on display in the Smithsonian. And so when I thought, this is the actual thing, you got to be kidding me. That's
right. Yeah. Well, it cost Gus Grissom his life and White and Chafee, right? I mean, he hung the lemon.
Command capsule that cost him his life. He died in the command capsule. He didn't have a limb on that mission.
No, I know, but I'm saying the whole Apollo program.
Mm. Oh, I see. Sorry.
With many tens of thousands of contractors, and all of this came together very neatly and very successfully. Baloney. You know, it's just can't be. It world doesn't work that way.
It doesn't. Mm-hmm. I would like to comment on just a couple of things you said earlier. You mentioned the 9/11 no planers thing. I don't really believe that in the no planers thing. I do believe 9/11 was a conspiracy, but I do indeed believe that there were planes hitting the World Trade Center at the time. I just wanted to get that out the way. And you mentioned earlier about the JFK thing. I honestly can't say that I saw much of the coverage on the telly at the time because I was too busy with my studies. I had an exam coming up, so I barely got a chance to catch the telly, see what was on the telly. But all that was on the telly was just this bullshit, really, propagating the Sloan gunman theory. In fact, I saw at least two documentaries all trying to go through all the trouble of trying to prove that a single bullet could cause all these wounds in Kennedy and Connolly. A single bullet traveled through these men. Not one of them showed that. Okay, you could hit two men with this thing if you could go through there, but you could not get it to hit him in the back and come out through his neck. You know, that's not going to happen.
The flight of that bullet in Kennedy would have had to change direction twice.
Yeah. You know,
the whole thing, well, that I just read the, we're a little off track here, but the James Tagg book. Very fine book. He's the guy who got a little wound, a harmless wound, really, on the cheek from a fragment of concrete from a fourth bullet. And the Warren Commission had already said, okay, there was two bullets from behind that hit JFK, and then there was one that hit Connolly. They were all ready to go. And then Tagg comes forward. Highly credible, it's verified by police witnesses and so on. And then they had, well, there's a fourth shot, so they had to have one bullet that go through Kennedy in addition to the other one, and then hit, take care of all of Connolly's wounds. That's, you know, the magic bullet theory that Arlen Specter is credited with, and Gerald Ford was an important member of the commission to push this absurdity, one of many absurdities, of course.
There was another documentary that I saw at the time. It tried to pin the one that hit Kennedy in the head. They tried to say, oh, it was shot by one of his security guards accidentally riding in the car behind them. Like, he tried to draw the gun to shoot Oswald, and, oh, he pulled the trigger, fell over, shot Kennedy in the head accidental. Oh, it was a big accident and everything else. And
I've never heard that one.
Forget the guy's name, but that was one of the documentaries I saw at the time, and I was just, oh my, it was really depressing because this was aired on the ABC. The ABC is our most reliable news network. The second most reliable is the SBS, and you know, this is the one that reported the smart one finding different minerals on the moon, different to the Apollo samples, and here they are reporting this thing trying to shift the blame away from. Oh my God!
Well, I think that takes us really to another topic we should discuss, and that is the Challenger disaster. And the Discovery Channel came out with a movie, and unfortunately, I missed it. But I've seen a couple of clips from the movie. It's a major motion picture that ran simultaneously on the History Channel one Saturday night and Discovery. And it's about something Gerald White had talked about earlier. Richard Feynman was part of this commission to investigate the Challenger. And he is an accomplished physicist and was an important voice for truth, at least partial truth. So let's talk about the Challenger disaster, Jera, again, and maybe the movie or what we know of it.
Yeah, I haven't seen the movie yet. I've been trying to get a copy of it, but I do know. I was a little concerned when I read that there wasn't anyone portraying Roger Beaujolais in the credits. You know, he was one of the most prominent figures about this whole disaster, and there's no one portraying him in the credits. So that had me a little concerned. However, the movie seems to be based in part on Truth, Lies, and O-Rings, which was a book by Al McDonald, who was one of the engineers trying to stop the launch. Now, there was a couple of things I wanted to correct when I was on the show last about the thing. You might remember how I mentioned one of the fire coal managers who was initially trying to stop the launch, but was later pressured into changing his mind. His name was Joe Kilminster. I likened him to Marty McFly. I said he was a kind of a wimp. I had it all wrong. Obviously, I meant George McFly. So, yeah, he's a real wimpy manager. And so Beaujolais, when they were presenting their things to NASA, trying to explain why this isn't going to work, why it's going to be a disaster, Beaujolais, he was always convinced that that Kilminster was going to say, okay, we can launch, because he's a real wimpy manager, and yet to his surprise, he said, we should not launch outside of our data bank, which means this is a no-go for launch. Of course, he was later forced to change his mind by NASA. The second thing I wanted to touch on was I mentioned how the heads at NASA, Jesse Moore and Arnold Aldrich, these were the guys who had the final say to launch.
Gera?
We lost him.
We lost the audio on Jura.
I was interested to hear that because it's very. I've just had quite a weird synchronicity here with this, what you've been talking about, because just today I was listening to a podcast that somebody had sent me, and that somebody was Richard Cook, who has written a book about the Challenger disaster, because he was involved in budgeting. In the NASA Space Shuttle program, and he also wrote a book because he became a whistleblower, and he actually had a memo written in 1985, which was in his files, where he had gone up to the higher ups in NASA and said, look, these O-rings are going to blow, one of these days. They need to be looked at properly. And I was actually listening to this podcast today. I think he did this podcast three or four months ago, and he sent me it probably a couple of months ago, because he actually contacted us regarding Dr. Wood's book, funnily enough, because he's now become interested in 9/11 as well, or he has in the last few years. So he was contacting us about that. And so I exchanged a few brief emails with him. But what he also said about the Challenger was very interesting, in that I think it became, he said that the group of people that he was involved with, they knew on the day, what happened. As soon as they saw the videos of the launch, and you saw these little streaks of flame coming out, they knew exactly that it was the O-rings that had gone. All of his team knew it because of this, he circulated this memo within his team. So they all knew it. And then, but the NASA guy, the NASA controller, He was new. He'd only been in the job about 6 months, so he wasn't aware of all these problems. So it was quite convenient for NASA for him to sort of go on TV and say, we never expected this. I never knew anything about this. That was true because he was new in the job. But of course, all the other people in Thiokol and everything, they knew this, and they'd issued a warning, and that obviously came out in the inquiry. Because of the cold weather, they'd said, no, we don't want to fly this. But apparently, why? Do you know why they flew it?
Well, there are two pieces of data that I know about. One was the Reagan administration pressure, political pressure to make it go.
Right, but why would they do that?
But then the other thing is Krista McAuliffe, wouldn't go along with lying. She was going to be the first school teacher in space.
That's right.
And she wasn't going to lie, for example, about not being able to see stars in space. In other words, to confirm the Apollo astronaut lies, okay? So well, those are at least two motives right there. Now, I think the engineers were pretty uniform in that you can't launch this thing at below 56 degrees Fahrenheit or something like that. And the morning.
Okay.
Are we still good? Andrew,
I can hear you. Yeah. I think it was trying to reconnect you on. I got momentarily put on hold. But carry on. Yes,
I think Pete is having problems getting Jira White back on.
Yeah.
I'm trying to connect with him. I'm sorry. I will momentarily.
Okay, but Andrew, why did they launch the Challenger, even though it was almost sure disaster?
What I'd literally listened to today, and again, it's such a strange synchronicity that this would come up, that what I'd heard is, yes, that the Reagan administration wanted to launch, and that was obviously the reason, but apparently what they wanted to do was get Christa McAuliffe speaking to Reagan as part of the State of the Union, you know, because it was around the time of that, and they were going to. Mm-hmm. Apparently, there were some sources in the press that this Richard Cook chap had, you know, he'd found out from sources in the press, because he was obviously curious why there was such a lot of pressure to get this launch up, and it was to do with Christa McAuliffe, but he'd said that sources in the press had been briefed that they were going to do a link up with Christa McAuliffe and speak to her, you know, about education and what a wonderful agency NASA was doing all this work and, you know, something like that. They were going to put this into the State of the Union address, so that's why they wanted to do it within that specific
time frame. Hello, I'm back.
Hi.
Hello? Hey, Jera.
Sorry, Jera. I got disconnected. I'm sorry.
Welcome back. Yeah. Andrew Johnson was just giving his account of the pressure by the Reagan administration to launch the Challenger. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that's about okay. So Jera, we talked about this on a previous show, but pick up on that. I mean, one of the issues was Christa McAuliffe was allegedly a very determined truthsayer, so she wasn't going to be manipulable on issues like not seeing stars in space, and then this could be. And, you know, as a threat to the whole mythology that built up.
Yeah. First of all, where did I leave off? I got cut off. I didn't realize how long I...
You've been gone 3 minutes or so, a good length of time.
It was the last thing I said. It was the last thing I said.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, you were talking about the NASA administrator and what their role was, pretty much cut off just after that.
Yeah, that's correct. They the people at NASA who had the final say to launch, that was Jesse Moore and Arnold Aldrich, right? They testified that they were not informed by Firecoal, who was telling Marshall Space Flight Center not to launch, and the Marshall Space Flight Center guys were to then inform the top NASA management that this is a no go, or this we have a go for launch, and they eventually pressured Firecoal into giving them a go for launch. They said, okay, we'll still let them know that you have concerns about launching in cold weather, but the top management people, they say they were never told this. However, in August of the previous year, right, Al McDonald, he actually, from Firecoal, he actually made a presentation in August 1985 explaining that launching in cold weather is a bad move.
It's a terrible, terrible thing. Completely irresponsible, if not first-degree murder, the Challenger disaster. You're listening to the Reynolds Reveal. So let's pick up after the break with Andrew Johnson and Jera White for more on space exploration. Majestic. How do you follow Jolson? You're listening to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and we are exploring space and the difficulties therein and the frauds that have been committed as landing on the moon, walking on the moon. And my guests are Andrew Johnson from the UK and Jera White from Sydney, Australia. Now, Jera, you wanted to complete some thoughts you had on some of your research on the Challenger disaster.
Yeah, that's correct. In August 19th, 1985, Al McDonald from Morton Farcoal, which was the company that built the solid rocket boosters, he actually gave a presentation at NASA headquarters explaining how we should not launch in cold weather because it would be a disaster. Now, it's important to note that first of all, Arnold Aldrich was there, but Jesse Moore was absent, but his assistant, Michael Weeks, was there. He was the fellow who later, after Challenger happened, he said, oh, why don't we just slap some heaters on the outside of the booster and continue to fly? So it's important to note that these people who had, well, one of them who had the final say to launch, he was at this presentation in August 1985, and yet after the Challenger happened, they said, oh, we weren't informed that this was going to be hazardous. They said we weren't passed the information from Marshall Space Flight Center. Marshall, they said, okay, we got the no launch recommendation, but we'll still tell the higher-ups, okay, that you had concerns about this, but they claim the higher ups, they claim they weren't told anything, but yet they were at this presentation, so they should have known.
It's outrageous. It's outrageous. And I mean, at a minimum, this is negligent manslaughter. And I think it was more than that.
I suspect it was most likely murder. Because Christy McAuliffe, she refused to be scripted by her government handlers, and she obviously would not go along with the myth that you cannot see stars on the daylight side of the Earth or the daylight side of the Moon, because if you could see stars on the daylight side of the Earth, then you should be able to see them on the Moon, and yet we have Armstrong claiming he couldn't see them.
You know, it's like I watched some of the ceremony in Dealey Plaza where after 50 years, the leaders and fathers of Dallas, Texas finally had a ceremony, and it was just a pity party. You know, there wasn't anything analytic about it at all because, hey, these are the descendants of the people who plotted and executed the murder of our president, JFK. So it just makes me angry when you scratch below the surface of any one of these mythologies and you quickly find out this is impossible. This official story is just a packed lot. And it just, maybe I'm overly emotional, but it makes me angry this day. I don't care how many years go by, and they're still covering it up.
Absolutely.
Well, Andrew Johnson had a very good idea, and that is a central topic, I think, for the rest of our final segment here should be various aspects of the Apollo moon hoax. It's still praised as the greatest technological achievement of man, and yet it's mostly a Hollywood production. And why do we know that? What are the main things that you would observe about that we have the evidence to show that it was a fraud, Andrew?
Well, I mean, you know, the things that I've looked at, which seem to become obvious over time, run through very quickly. I mean, certainly Neil Armstrong's 1994 speech in the White House on the 25th anniversary, where he starts off talking about, you know, he says, it's said that a parrot can talk, but it doesn't fly very well, so I'll keep this short. That's what he opened his 25th anniversary speech with, which is a very curious turn of phrase. And then a bit later in the speech, he talks about, you know, there are breakthroughs available and great ideas undiscovered to those who can remove one of truth's protective layers. And I think, you know, when you learn, for example, that Aldrin's marriage of 38 years ended in 1994, you begin to wonder if he was feeling that he needed to disclose the truth at that time. And that would obviously put pressure on his personal relationships and so on. So I think for those that
are you saying Buzz Aldrin, Andrew, or Neil Armstrong?
I meant to say Neil Armstrong. It's nearly, okay. It's getting towards midnight here, so my brain's maybe not quite as accurately okay. firing my mouth muscles as it should be. So Armstrong was speaking, and Armstrong's marriage broke up. So, you know, I think if people start looking not only at the physical evidence, but also the behavioural evidence, I mean, I know Gerard touched on that a little bit with the appearance of Buzz Aldrin. I think those things, but also...
Andrew, along that same line of the human, we'll call it, what should we say... failed lying or revealing the truth in a almost inadvertent way. Remember Bart Sibrel? Yes. I remember I watched all five of his videos, and he has I think it's a pretty it's looked like a complete tape of that press conference in the auditorium after I don't know a few weeks had gone by and the astronauts are alleged, and it was so sad. It was so sad, the whole atmosphere. And it was watching this lying up there on the stage was painful.
Yes, yes. I think, you know, and
If I may interject one quick thing.
Yes, Sarah, go ahead.
I find it really ironic how when he's giving this presentation, how he says, okay, the parrot, and he didn't fly very well. It's really ironic how they named their lunar module Eagle, and yet he goes on to liken himself to parrots, which cannot fly very well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's another interview with Armstrong in 2005, which you know I managed to track down. And in that, he's asked by the interviewer, says what the interviewer says, I've heard you say that you've said to other press people, when will I stop being known as a spaceman? And so he says, well, why would you want to, you know, stop being known as a spaceman? That's what the interviewer asks Armstrong, you know, and Armstrong says, well, I'd rather be known for the ledger of my daily work than for one piece of fireworks. So, like, I just found it extremely peculiar that Armstrong would describe the Apollo 11 mission as a piece of fireworks. I mean, it just seems extremely odd that somebody like him would describe it with that characterization, you know?
That's like the commentary that they put on. Ah, good show. Fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. There's another interview by Armstrong that just came to mind. He gave an interview to 60 Minutes a few years ago, and I forget the reporter's name right now, but he asked him, "You don't seem to be embrace your fame and praise, whatever it was that he said very very well, and all this praise that has been garnered on him." And he says, "Well, no, I just don't deserve it." That was his answer. He says, "I don't deserve."
Well, I think wasn't that Ed Bradley who did that?
That's
on
the same interview. I think both come from the same.
His farm in Ohio, I believe. But you know, when Armstrong came out and gave the original prepared remarks in August of 1963 for this big press conference, he started up by talking about this was just one event in a long effort and to so many people involved. And there he was here again, you know, trying to push the spotlight away from him. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people just dismiss that as, oh, he's just a modest, unassuming man. But I think it's, there's a lot more to it than that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I sense that. And, you know, and then of course, Bart Sibrel's, rather uncomfortable interview with Edgar Mitchell, and the way that ends with Mitchell's son saying, you know, they accidentally leave a wireless camera mic running, and Mitchell's son is heard saying, as Bart Sibrel's leaving the house, he says, Mitchell's son says, "Shall we call the CIA and have him waxed?" You know, and that's on camera. And it's just extraordinary. That is just, I mean, to me, to have that on camera, that is just extraordinary, you know, that somebody
Jarrah White and I have in a previous show talked about these various people who were murdered or died or killed under suspicious circumstances.
Yeah, particularly that Thomas Ronald Barron fellow who testified with a 500-page document explaining how bad the Apollo program was. There's too many safety violations. There's too many problems with the design. There's this, there's that. And then after he testified, 3 days later, he was found dead at a railroad crossing where his car got crushed by the train.
So, and I'll bet you there was little or no investigation of suspicious mechanical or electrical arrangements to make that happen.
Yeah, and I mean similarly with Gus Grissom and his son, you know, Scott. He did an investigation in, I think it was in the 90s. I'm sure Gerard would know about that better than I would. But
it was 1997, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, and he'd got evidence that they'd actually rigged the capsule to cause a spark, and you know they filled it with pure oxygen. So that whole thing looks like again like another. You know, almost ritualistic killing, basically.
They found evidence that the metal plate had been shoved behind the dashboard to trigger a spark. Yeah. That's what he found.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, but when you're up against a bunch of Nazi criminals, you know, then I think that's not too unsurprising behavior when you realize what the history of the early days of the Apollo program was.
You know, it's a very interesting thing if you think about the hiring and firing of evil managers. You want some people who are safe, shall we say, and keeping a secret because you don't want to pay a lot of money or threaten people or actually kill them too often. There's too many, you know, some things can go wrong with every one of those events. So. And yet you need some kind of a pretense of competence or actual competence. And a lot of competent people are people of integrity. There's a positive correlation there. So I'm just thinking about it from a Dr. Evil point of view here. It's hard to get good help if you're going to run this magnificent fraud.
If we're talking about truly evil managers and stuff, here's a good story. This is what Roger Beaujolais told me in his interview. He said that the center director at the Marshall Space Flight Center, he had everybody scared for their careers, not just at NASA, but also at the contractors, because he had the ability to crush their careers in a heartbeat. And he had basically said that the Marshall Center would never, ever, ever be held responsible for delaying a flight. And I'll quote Beaujolais here. He said, "Now that's sick. A man like that should have been taken out and shot right on the spot." I asked him, "Can I quote you on that?" And Beaujolais' direct response was, "Sure you can."
Wow.
That's in the interview that I recorded with Beaujolais.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you told the story. It might have been the same manager who said, "You guys need to take off your engineer caps and put on your management cap."
That was a different fellow. That was Gerald Mason, I believe. He told that to the vice president of engineering, Robert Lund. The guy who should have been taken out and shot was a guy by the name of William Lucas. He was the center director at Marshall Space Flight Center. The guy who said, "Take off your engineering hat and put in a management hat," he was at the contractor, Firecoal.
Andrew Johnson, we got into a very interesting discussion here. Regarding really the human aspect of Apollo and why it's not credible. And so give us some more, what do you think of when you, what is good evidence for exposing the Apollo moon hoax?
Well, another of the ones that, you know, I came across, which seemed fairly obvious once I discovered it, was to do with the temperatures involved on the surface of the moon, basically. Oh, no, it's not a human angle so much. But if people haven't watched it already, watch Astronauts Gone Wild, the Bart Sobel film, if you want to see some of the reaction of what these astronauts say when they're confronted with certain questions, how they behave. It's very revealing, I think. But going back to the temperature issues, you know, there's this photograph of I think Charlie Duke and his family, which is, I think, was Apollo 17, I think.
And 16.
Sorry, that's right. And they put this in a plastic bag on the surface of the moon. And then he photographs it as, you know, presumably the sort of all-American family, you know, nice family photograph taken with him on this dangerous mission and then laid out for the cosmos to see on the moon, you know, sort of thing, and this sort of crazy idea. But unfortunately, if you were to take a photograph and put it in your oven, which I did, you know, and switch it up to 100 degrees centigrade, within about 10 seconds of it going in the oven, the photograph will curl up almost into a, you know, a tube, and that also would have happened with this if this had been on the real surface of the moon. So I think that photograph right there, you know, you're completely taking away any arguments about shadows or reflectivity or artificial light sources. It's a physical effect which you can observe for yourself, which didn't happen on that movie set. It just did not happen. And then, of course, it becomes easier for you to realize that the same would have applied to the film and the cameras, that even if the film hadn't just outright melted, which it would have really, it would have at least warped, and so that to the extent that it would not have traveled through the camera properly and it would have scraped against the back of the camera, you know, and so on, and the chemicals would have degraded from the temperature, if not from the radiation. You know, so you start looking at all those things and you begin to see that they just could not have, they could not have taken those photographs in that way, in the way that's alleged. It just was not possible.
Yeah, what you said about the camera, that actually brings me to something that I remember, is that David Percy, he interviewed, what's his name, Bloomberg, who was the guy who manufactured the cameras, right? He was asked, how did these photographs survive the conditions? He said, well, there was nothing special about the camera. It must have been the film. So they speak Douglas Arnold, who was at Kodak, and they asked him how the film survived, and they said, oh, it was just ordinary film. It was essentially the same as ordinary film, so it must have been the camera that was special.
Yeah.
As I recall, that Hasselblad guy in Sweden said, well, you'll have to ask NASA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Oh, yeah. Shift the buck. Yeah. Hey, here's a question I have that I think is, we might call it real physical science, and that really bothers me, and that is, this comes up with the Chang'e 3 pictures too, or video, and that is, wouldn't the sunlight on sunny side of the moon be brilliant? I mean, at least what the Earth has, and just, well, the abundant high light everywhere, and yet these sets, I could call them, are kind of a, you know, dim. Nobody would mistake this for a sunny day on planet Earth, much less sunlight unimpeded by an atmosphere ought to be quite brilliant. I don't get that.
There's 20% more sunlight on the moon, and I believe that, as I said, I'm not sure if the Chang'e 3 mission is for real. I believe that the reason it's probably dark is because, as I said, the moon doesn't have that much reflectivity. It's only about as bright as an asphalt road.
And then you could argue that the aperture openings and all this photographic insider stuff is compensating for brilliant sun. I guess you'd have to argue that.
Yeah, Andrew, I'll let Andrew talk.
Andrew.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that was coming into my mind when you were saying that is, again, this problem of verification. You know, I've come to the conclusion that, you know, the there are obviously secret agencies running things, and it appears that they can manipulate what they need to manipulate to carry out their agenda. And so at the moment, we don't really have, for example, two current moon missions that are running at the same time that we've both got free and open access to, that we could then, you know, flip between one window and another on our computer and see if all the photographic evidence stacks up. We can't do that. You know, there's no current Russian mission, there's no current American mission, there's only the Chinese mission, and I think Jarrah's done an excellent job of illustrating.
It's also the LRO. There's also the LRO currently in orbit.
True, that is true. Maybe I was overlooking that. But just you know, what I was going to say is that we know that the Chinese, from what you've already described, have, you know, wanted to control the information very closely. So, you know, we can expect that they've got things in place you know, to keep secrets pretty comprehensively. But yeah, so I think what would be interesting is if we get an opportunity to cross reference the data from LRO with the data from the Chinese, you know, current data, that would be quite interesting.
So, but what's really aggravating, as Jarrah White has told me, and you've got at least three mechanisms that should be able to identify quite clearly the remains, the artifacts of the Apollo moon landings, or confirm the Chang'e 3 alleged landing, right? You got the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, you got Hubble, you got the Very Large Telescope. They could, hone right in and very fine detail, couldn't they, Jarrah?
Yeah, the Hubble could only see the disturbed area of soil, whereas the LRO and the Very Large Telescope in Chile, they are supposed to be able to both resolve the artifacts. I prefer the VLT, because, you know, with a ground-based telescope, you've got your own control of it. It's not filtered through any government handlers or whatnot and stuff. And yet, they said they were going to use this to find the artifacts, and now we're told, they told me in personal email, they said, we've never used it to look at the moon. Now we're told, it can't be used to look at the moon at all. Can't be used to find the artifacts and everything else. No explanation is given. And then there's the LRO, which has a whole heap, which is just garbage pictures,
yeah,
especially when you compare them to the GOI-1 spacecraft. And in fact, I believe, Andrew, you had something to say. You actually compared the pixel sizes of the...
Well, that's the right, yeah. I mean, I looked at your videos on that, which I found very interesting. I think I stole the GOI pictures from your video, or, you know, a link from your video or something. So, yeah, but then I did the measurements on the original, you know, fanfare image from 2009, I think it was, the re-imaging of the Apollo 11 site. And if you measure the alleged the size of the which alleges to be the the lunar excursion module base section, or whatever you call it, it's about three times too big, as I calculated it. I think 2.5 times too big. If you compare that image with the pixel size and the actual size of the image, so it's that right there is another thing. It shows it cannot be real.
Hey, we just are going to return to Earth, but what a journey. I've learned so much, and I actually enjoy some physical science. I used to be adverse like most Americans are, but it really inspires an interest when we talk about this context of exploring space. So I thank Andrew Johnson of the UK so much, as well as Jarrah White, who's a burgeoning astrophysicist. Go see his site, moonfaker.com, and look at his videos on YouTube. Thank you so much, gentlemen, for such an informative and fun program.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.